You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author who helps empower horse people from all over the world with the skills, knowledge, and mindsets needed to create trusting partnerships with their horses. Warwick offers a free 7-day trial to his comprehensive online video library that includes hundreds of full-length training videos and several home study courses at videos.warwickschiller.com. Just because you see
what it shows. G'day everyone, welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host Warwick Schiller, and as usual, we have another amazing guest today. But before we get to that amazing guest, I want to talk about some of our previous amazing guests and how amazing it has been to have them at our podcast summit. So we've had two US summits so far and one in Australia. And this year in 2024, we are going to have one in Birmingham, England. It's on August 1st to the 4th. And these podcast summits, we have, you know, the amazing guests from the podcast come. They present on stage over 3 days, where they do a 20-minute TED-type talk, and then we have some panel discussions. The energy at the ones we've had so far have been amazing, and I'm so excited about this UK one because of the presenters we are going to have there. And the presenters we're going to have there are some of your favorite podcast guests. You know, if you think about, we're having Chantel Pratt, we're having Kathy Price, Will Rogers, Rupert Isaacson, again, the amazing Denise Elizabeth Byron's going to be coming from America over to that, Tanya Kindersley, Jennifer Zeligs, who used to live here in California, now lives in England, Katrina McDonald, the amazing Ben Atkinson, Helen Spencer. If you guys haven't listened to the podcast with Helen Spencer, she was in the first year's podcast, and she's an amazing adventurer. Christine Dixon's coming from America. Gareth Marie's coming all the way from South Africa to present. And probably for me, the big draw card that a lot of people are excited about is Emily Kaysdotter will be coming from Sweden. And we've probably had more feedback from people about Emily's podcast than any of the other ones. And I think Emily's was about episode 114, something like that. And at the time I said it took 113 episodes to get people ready to take in what Emily had to say. And so, yeah, I'm just so excited about this UK podcast summit. And, you know, can you imagine what it's going to be like having all of those people in the same room, plus having a room full of people who are just vibing on what those people are putting out? It's going to be spectacular. So it's, you know, there's limited tickets available. So I would get in soon if possible. And once again, the dates are the 1st to the 4th of August. And if you want to get tickets for that, you can just go to summit.warwickschiller.com and you can get your tickets online there. And that brings me to today's guest. So today's guest is Nicole Glassman, and she is a holistic health practitioner and founder of Mindful Health, a holistic health practice in New York City. And a little blurb on then says, Mindful Health is a holistic health company in New York City founded by Nicole Glassman. Our strong foundation in holistic medicine, emotional healing, and natural lifestyle support helps our clients to heal, feel, and develop a more intuitive understanding of their bodies. And so today I talked to Nicole and talk about the journey that led her from being a patient focused on her own wellness, and that took her down a path of helping people do the same thing. So I hope you guys enjoy this conversation with Nicole as much as I did. Nicole Glassman, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
I'm glad you are here. I was just thinking, I was trying to figure out how did I find you? How did you find me? How did we end up get connected?
I am in a group on Facebook from a book that I read, actually, and it's a it was a book about manifesting. And I asked in the group, anybody have any podcasts that they find inspiring that they want to, you know, share? Yours was mentioned, and then when I started listening, I was like, wow, I really resonate with this, and so that's how I found you.
Oh, that's how you found me. Sometimes I find people, and sometimes people find me. Yeah. What was the book? The manifesting book that the Facebook group was about.
It's called Manifest. highly recommend it. It's really like a tangible guide to how to manifest in your life. So how to bring more of what you want into your life in a way that has like very much step-by-step actionable things to do that are realistic, that are tangible, that are digestible. Things like creating affirmations each day, visualizing, you know, what you want to bring more of into your life, creating intentions, getting rid of limiting beliefs, and a lot of stuff. It helps you to like dig deep. But I found it to be very easy to follow and captivating. So I recommend it.
I love that getting rid of limiting beliefs. Have you ever heard of a guy named Jake Ducey?
I have, but I don't know why. Remind me.
He wrote a book a number of years ago. So he was a I don't know if it was a protege of Jack Kornfield or was just enamored with him, but he was inspired by Jack Kornfield. And he wrote a book when he was like 21 or 20. Like he was very, very young. But I used to see him around social media. I'm not sure what he's doing these days. This is probably 8 or 9 years ago. And there was a video he did one day, you know, all the stuff I'd read about manifesting is, you know, you got to put it out there, blah, 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 blah. And he said, manifesting, manifesting tells you, you put it out there what you want, you know, and he said, you don't get what you want, you get who you are.
That is so spot on based on what I was just reading. It was like a big part of the visualization and a big part of the manifesting is to imagine your life as if this was your reality. Who are you in that picture? What are you bringing in? Who is with you? If you were to have this life, what would you be doing to kind of be in that life? So it could be, in order to have that life, maybe you need to exercise every day as part of your motivation to keep you on track. Maybe it's you're keeping notes in your gratitude journal. And it's like, do those things now, because if you're going to have that life, start living it as if it's now. And it's all about feeling. Like, what does this vision feel like to you? What does this future feel like to you? Not just what does it look like, but what does it feel like? So I found that really interesting too.
You know, I had a guest on the podcast in the first year, so 3 years ago. Her name's Susan, Dr. Susan Fay, and she works with horses. But a lot of what she does with horses is about transmitting an emotion, and that it's almost like the same thing with this. Mm-hmm. You've got to have the emotion of the thing you want. But I just thought it was so interesting that you don't, because I'd always, you know, I by this point in time, I had realized that I'd been manifesting for quite a while. And I thought it was because of I was getting what I wanted. And then I realized, oh no, I was getting who I was. And I realized that for a long time, the things weren't coming to me because I wasn't being a certain person. And it's, you know, for me, I always come from stuff on the back end. Like I'd started being different and then things started happening, but I wasn't trying to be different for the things to happen. Whereas people that read their book, they realize I've got to be different. And I think that's hard because, and it's kind of the same as when I'm helping people with their horses. You've got to be able to do it with no expectation of the outcome. You know, it's like, I talk about, you know, they say that one of the most spiritually ancient Hindu practices is called karma yoga, and karma yoga is focusing on a task with no thought as to the outcome of that task. And so the whole manifesting thing, a friend of mine who was also on the podcast from Wales, Kathy Price, she says, intention, attention, no tension. And I think the no tension is the thing people struggle with.
It's that whole detachment, you know, detaching from the outcome and like allowing. Yes. And that's definitely a practice because we want to control.
That's a hard thing to do. And that book was called Manifesting?
Yeah, it's called Manifest.
Who's it by?
Roxy Nafusi is the author. It's very good.
Not heard of that one. Have you ever read E Squared?
No.
E Squared's about manifesting too, and it too is a step-by-step thing. And, you know, you start out manifesting the tiniest little thing and it works your way up to big things. But the first exercise in E Squared, and you've probably heard this experiment before, but they want you to go online and buy yourself a new car, but don't buy it. Just look through there and think, if I was outside, if I had more money than I currently have, if I had an unlimited budget, what car would I buy and mentally buy that car? And then for the next month, see how many times you see that car, that exact make, model. And then the next month, I think they have you give yourself a modest budget, like $5,000 or something or other, go online, pretend you buy that car and keep an eye out for them. And it's basically just coaching you to understand that you see what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. You know, you see what you're expecting. And if you're expecting the crappy car, you'll see a lot of them. And if you're expecting the other one, you'll see a lot of them. And then it works its way up, you know.
Well, and it's also like as you're, you know, even thinking of something like that or trying to imagine it, sometimes then the belief comes up. You know, well, what is it that's holding me back? Like, what's that reaction I feel when I even imagine that I could have those things? And that gets you digging a little deeper too.
Yes, there's a lot of digging, and I'm planning on digging into your story here. Sure. We got a little off track with the manifesting, but I'm glad you mentioned that book and that Facebook group. What's the Facebook group called?
Manifest by Roxy Nafusi. It's basically the group connected to the book, just for people to kind of, you know, bounce ideas and what their experiences have been and all that.
Awesome. Okay, so why don't you tell us what you currently do in the world? Oh, before you, I'm going to have you tell us that. But the thing I love about the podcast, like if I just got back from a horse expo in Iowa, and I have at these horse expos, I'll have people come up to the booth, and when they see me, they'll a lot of times they'll have tears in their eyes. Sometimes they well up. Sometimes they can't even talk. I had to have one girl sit there. I had to come behind the desk and sit down in the chair, and I said, just sit here and breathe for a second. And it's a lot. I've come to realize that's nothing to do with me. It's the fact that I'm associated with some life change they've had, but a lot of times it's the podcast guests who have said something, suggested a book, you know, whatever, and has changed the course of this person's life. And I just had an email this morning from someone who, like was in a very dark place and was thinking about some serious self-harm, and one of the podcast guests inspired that person to do some things differently. And it's just like, well, the whole episode was worth it if one person was, if one person was affected. Well, the story I'm going to have you tell, your story, I guarantee you it's going to affect more than one person, because it's, I think the story you're going to tell is probably a pretty common sort of a story. And the two bits of feedback I get from podcast listeners are they either get validated, as in, oh, me too, I have that problem. I thought I was the only one with that problem. And the other probably bit of feedback I get is they're either validated or they're inspired, and they kind of go, I could show up a lot better in the world. I could be having a bigger impact on the world, or I could be showing up different in the world. And I'm guessing your story is probably going to inspire both of those.
Oh, well, that's very kind. I hope so.
So why don't you start out telling us what exactly it is you do in the world now? And it so happens to be that you do it for your living, but it's more about what are you bringing to the world. It's the same thing. But why don't you tell us about that? And then I want to unravel the, I think, a long story to how you got to be doing what you're doing. Because I think you're one of those people who the thing that you are doing what you're doing is because you had some struggles, and through those struggles you learned about a different way of looking at the world, and now you are sharing that with others. So I'll stop rambling and you can tell us what you currently do.
So I run a holistic health practice in Manhattan. I see clients privately for a whole array of health issues. I do nutrition. I do a type of testing called electrodermal screening, where I go through and check different points on their hands and feet that correlate to acupuncture meridians. And then I get readings on my screen to see how, you know, things in their body are functioning, maybe where they need a little bit more support, where they might have been exposed to some toxins, where there could be some allergies. And then there's a whole other side of the business where I do some work with their chakra system. It's, which for me is a way to bridge the physical and the emotional in their life and kind of put it all together. And then the other piece is I also do retreats. So I've done, you know, for many years I've done group retreats, and now I've started a new program where I'm doing one-on-one retreats or two-person retreats where it's very individualized to kind of help support someone with where they are in their life now. So that's what I'm doing. But you know, how I got here was because of my own health issues. And would you like me to share that?
Oh, we're not even going to get to them yet.
Okay.
We want to go back to the beginning because, you know, I want to know the path your life took. But let's go back a second. You just mentioned something called electrodermal screening. What is that?
So it's a machine that was actually created based on the idea that the meridian system, which is what acupuncture is, you know, founded on, that the meridians can actually be measured. So basically what it's doing is I go through like a minimum of 48 points on the hands and on the feet. I touch those points with it looks like almost like a pen, and I'm touching the point, and then I'm getting a reading on my screen to see if something is inflamed, which is, you know, or balanced. And usually that something is like the digestive system, the thyroid, the kidneys, the liver. It's going through the body. At the end, I take a look at, you know, all of the results. I see which area of the body needs the most support. And then the next step is to ask why. So then I go back and I check through and I see, you know, is there, you know, some kind of toxin that they were exposed to? Is pesticides showing up or heavy metals showing up? Is there a food sensitivity? Is there, you know, an allergy? Is there a vitamin deficiency? Also, you know, taking into account a lot of the emotional stressors and what a person's going through in their life too. You know, all of that kind of gets put together. And then from those test results, I check to see what remedies will balance someone. And then I create a nutrition plan based on also what I saw in the test. So for example, if someone was showing up with like a lot of liver congestion, then I may suggest, you know, certain foods actually that can help with the liver in our nutrition session. Or if blood sugar showed up as an issue, then I really focus a lot on that in the nutrition. So it's a whole picture. You know, when, with what I'm doing, I'm looking at the emotions, I'm looking at the physical, we're looking at the food. And then, you know, I feel better equipped to be able to help someone from that.
So it's a very, well, you did say, you did mention the word holistic in the beginning. Mm-hmm. It's a very holistic thing. And that's, yeah, I think that is basically what's missing from everything today, just medicine, but. But yeah, definitely. So let's go back to what led you to that. So you you were interested in journalism when you were you went to college. You were interested in journalism. Mm-hmm. What got you interested in journalism? Did you like? Were you one of those people that kind of almost want to be like an investigator, investigative journalist? Was it more the writing part, or was it more the finding out who's doing the wrongs and righting the wrongs of the world? What was it? What was your journalism draw?
Such an interesting question. Everybody tells me I'm very inquisitive. So I think I genuinely like to learn about people and situations and things, but I also love to write. So I think it was a combination. I wasn't necessarily picturing myself as an investigative journalist. I kind of, even, you know, in later years when I did do some writing, I was actually writing about people's experiences or things people have come through or like transformational journeys. And so I think I still was looking to write about things that could have an impact for people. You know, even though I wasn't necessarily doing health then, you know, but it's, I loved it, but I just think it wasn't my ultimate road.
Sounds like you were interested in writing the journey, doing journalism of the journey on podcast.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah.
And so you went to college for that. Did you end up getting that degree and did you go into like the field of journalism?
So what happened was I actually had a job lined up after my senior year of college in Florida with a magazine. Everything was planned out and it actually had gotten the job through someone I knew from high school who happened to be an editor there. And then when I went to reach out to go through all the details, like the final steps of what needed to be done, you know, to complete whatever they needed for me, I found out she no longer worked there and hadn't told anybody that she had hired me. I think this was the universe like intervening and saying, this is not your path, you know, but at the time it was catastrophe. So I never ended up working specifically. I did internships in journalism, like all throughout college. But when it came to like my first real job, it fell through. And that's what kind of started a whole chain of events for me in, you know, sort of figuring out a whole other path.
In your bio, it mentions that you studied in Italy. When was Italy in relation to that?
That was my junior year of college. I did a study abroad program in Florence.
Oh, really? Florence is beautiful, isn't it?
Oh, it was the most amazing experience ever. I highly recommend it.
You basically did the Julia Roberts in Eat, Pray, Love.
I know, just before her. I inspired her.
I mean, did you inspire her? It's actually Elizabeth Gilbert you inspired.
Yes.
She wrote the
I love that book.
Have you ever read Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert?
I did, yes. Yeah. I love Elizabeth Gilbert. Yeah, I heard her speak too. She came to New York. I think it was after Eat, Pray, Love came out. She's an excellent speaker.
Is she?
It was, yeah.
I bet that was cool. So how did, tell us about, you know, I've been to Florence, but I've not lived in Italy. And imagine a lot of our listeners haven't lived in Italy for a year. What's that? Oh, where did you grow up before you
go to Italy? I grew up in Florida, actually, in Delray Beach, Florida.
Okay. So like beachy, hot weather.
Yes.
Okay. Your study abroad thing, did you choose Italy or was it, or did you want to study abroad and they say this is where you're going?
I did choose Italy. Yeah. Okay. I actually, growing up, I went to Europe quite a few times with my family in the summer and they were obsessed with Italy. So I really kind of felt like that was where I wanted to be. I had been there a number of times, but going as a student and in that capacity was very different than going, you know, as a vacationer.
Right. So how was it? How long did you live there?
6 months.
Did you speak Italian before you
got
there?
Not at the time, no. I did take Italian when I lived there. I really tried to focus on learning it. And even though when I came back, I took Italian on and off for like 5 years. I was determined to try to still keep the language. But, you know, when you're not practicing it with, you know, the average person, it's a little harder to keep. But I did try. I still love it. I love the language. I love listening to it. I definitely cannot really speak it right now. I can understand a little bit, but ask me to say something and I'd fumble around.
Right. Probably hello and goodbye and where's the loo?
Yeah. Or as my dad says, he speaks menus, you know.
Speaking of menus, I would say the tastiest thing I've ever eaten in my entire life was in Florence.
What did
I
you have?
Ordered a truffle ravioli.
Oh.
And this plate showed up with these seven little raviolis on it. And I'm thinking, is that it? They were so rich, I almost couldn't get them all done. But like the tastiest food I've ever eaten.
I can imagine. I mean, food is an experience there. It's not just the food. Mm. There's an experience around all of it. You know, it's the love they put into it. It's the quality of the produce. There's heart in everything that you eat and you feel it. So it's whole another level.
Yeah. So you were there for 6 months. What was, if you were going to give me like the coolest thing that ever happened to you while you're in Italy or the funnest experience you had or whatever, do you have any of those to share?
There was so much. I mean, I think something that I loved was just how accessible all the countries were by train. So on the weekends we would travel and I got to see so much of Europe so easily, where, you know, here things are a little more spread out or the train system isn't connected in the same way. So, you know, we went to Prague, we went to Budapest. There were things that we did that were just like easy and here we were in like a whole other country. And at that time, you know, we didn't have the internet the way we do now. I sound like I'm like from the dark ages, but it wasn't like everything was as connected as it is. So you really felt immersed in the experience when you were there because, you know, you didn't have a phone that had everything at your fingertips. You know?
Well, the other thing is you didn't have a phone to be videoing and taking pictures of stuff to put on Instagram.
That's so true.
In the moment.
Exactly. We had to go to, I was just telling someone about this. We had to go to internet cafes to like send emails. Like we didn't have the internet right there and we certainly weren't texting or you were really present. So I'm very grateful I did that when I did, because now I would imagine it's so different.
Yeah. So different, especially, you know, we were a little older when it got to that point. I can't imagine being a teenager these days or being the parents of a teenager these days or being the parents of kids at all, really, with phones and, yeah, that's got to be tough. Okay. So the big thing that led you to what you are currently doing now with some health issues, and I think there's probably a lot of unraveling in that. So what did that start out as, and when did it start?
It started out as stress. I was this person, like all of my friends in college were sort of rolling with the punches of what they were doing next. And I was the, oh, I have it figured out. If I don't have it figured out, something will happen. Like very much needed to be in control, needed to know what the next steps in my life looked like. So as I mentioned, I had that job lined up, and then it fell through, and I just started experiencing, I guess, uncertainty and, you know, a lot of unknown about what was next. And I think that started to lead to, you know, some digestive issues. I was experiencing, you know, some burning in my digestion. My lower back was hurting. It kind of was like a slow progression, but then it became something where I was like, this isn't normal. I was never feeling this before. And I wasn't even experiencing pressure from my family to figure anything out, like what my career looked like. This was all me. So I think I was really struggling in the unknown. And it just was paralyzing to me because I think, you know, up until that point, so much is planned out for you. You go to school until this age, you go to your next school. And it just was a point where I actually had choice, and the choice I made didn't work. And then it was like, okay, I got to figure this out. And I didn't know. I didn't know like what the next steps were. So I think all of that unknown brought out some things that were probably already there, but the stress magnified it so that I had to start investigating, like, why am I feeling like this? Of course I'm stressed, but is there another reason? And so I started down, you know, the Western route of going to doctors, I went to a doctor that my dad, you know, was going to, a gastroenterologist. It was a really terrible experience. The doctor was very dismissive. He sat there half the time talking to my dad about wine, and like they were like sharing stories, barely acknowledged me. And when he did, he tried to give me a prescription for antidepressants. And meanwhile, I was saying, like, I'm having this what felt like acid all the time in my digestive system. I was like 22 years old. It wasn't normal for me. I'd never experienced this. He never ran any tests, never did anything, just wanted to give me an antidepressant. And, you know, at the time, like I was not in this holistic world at all, but I knew in my gut, this was just not right. So then there was
Are you going to a gastroenterologist with a stomach problem and he's going to give you an antidepressant?
Antidepressant. Yeah. Didn't even try to figure out what could be causing it. So it was just, definitely dismissive. There's elements, there's emotional things that come up during an experience like this, because you don't feel heard, you don't feel seen, you feel crazy sometimes because people minimize what you're saying and what you're feeling. Because there were, you know, quite a few doctors I went to and many similar experiences. There was even a holistic doctor I went to that was not good. So this isn't to knock, you know, just Western. I went to one doctor who tried to tell me that I needed to get my own goat and have fresh goat milk and milk my own goat in order to cure my digestive system. I'm like, this is not practical. What are you even saying? So there just was like, it's almost like a comedy of errors. When I look back on it now, it's almost funny, but not when you're experiencing it, you know, because you're looking for answers. So all of this, years of this experience led me to try to find my own answers. And that's what led me to the journey of where I am now.
So what, you know, you've gone down the Western medicine route. One of them wants to give you anxiety meds or antidepressant meds. One wants you to keep a goat in your apartment. what do you think was like the first, I mean, there's a lot to your journey to what you're doing now. What do you think was your first step out of like the hamster wheel of not getting anywhere? What was the first thing that made something of a difference?
I was seeing a holistic practitioner in Florida, and she was starting to get to the bottom. She was doing kinesiology, like some type of muscle testing. She was starting to get to the bottom of some of my issues. And then while we were working together, I went to a health food store there, and there was a woman who was actually doing the test that I was mentioning that I do now, the electrodermal screening. Mm-hmm, and yeah. She offered to test me. And normally I would have not done something like that because I would be like, what is this? But I was kind of desperate at that point to figure out what was going on. And she found that I had heavy metals and a parasite and that there were some underlying things that, yes, there was stress, but there were toxins that were being activated by the stress. So I took that information back to the practitioner that I was going to, and she was able to dig further and kind of put all the pieces together. So it was almost like both approaches. That was, I think, the most significant piece that got me started. And then, you know, from there, there were many other things that I kind of added on, but I would say that was those were my first big steps to making some changes.
And this is quite a bit of time into trying to figure out what was going on. Now, I've got a list of stuff here that you had going on. It says leaky gut, candida, hormone imbalance, thyroid deficiency. Were your symptoms getting worse as time went on? Like you started out with, you know, a bit of gut stuff and then it was getting more, the snowball effect, it was getting more and more out of whack?
Yeah. Then my weight started getting affected. My skin was breaking out. I remember a summer where I had to fly to a friend's wedding and I was wearing like a back brace because my back was, just, I was having such a hard time like bending forward that I was just wearing, you know, a back brace you could get yourself just to be able to stand up straight because I was in her wedding. So there was like, it was manifesting in many ways and it was kind of going in ebbs and flows. Like there were times where certain things were flaring up, then something might calm down a little and something else would flare up. I was like taking hot baths to try to bring the like acid feeling down in my stomach. It was pretty crazy because I mean, I was in my 20s and I was young to be dealing with all of that, but it did feel like it was getting worse at times.
And were you a journalist at the time?
No, I had a number of different jobs. Like I was trying to figure out what I was doing. I was teaching English as a second language. I was working at an international school. Then I ended up working in a holistic health practitioner's office just to learn more as I was getting more into that. Then I moved to Chicago and had a job there. Like there was a lot of movement going around, but I wasn't in my field yet. I was still exploring what felt right and where I wanted to live and, you know, all of that.
So you're teaching English as a second language. Were you teaching it to a particular group of people that all had the same first language?
Yes, yeah, Spanish. It was in South Miami and they...
Oh, okay, yeah.
Wonderful people. And like many of them had lived in Miami for many, many years and didn't speak a word of English. Right. So I was teaching them.
You know, where we live in California, there's lots of native Spanish speakers here. And the town that we live, you know, about 8 miles out of the center of town. And when we drive into town, the first business you come to that will actually sell you food is a little Mexican market, carniceria, you know, so you can get your burritos and stuff there, but they also, it's a little grocery store sort of thing. And, we call it our OG Mexican place, you know.
Yeah.
And I was in there one day and there was a, probably in not in the where you get your burritos, but in the checkout part of the little supermarket thing, there was a 16, 17 year old Hispanic girl working there and did not speak a lick of English. So think about in this, like living in America in this day and age, being 16, 17, whatever, and don't speak a word of English. It was like, well, that's a OG Mexican store. It's really cool. Yeah, you go in there. It's cool. You go in there. You could be in Mexico.
That's awesome. That part of Miami is like that too. I mean, I don't know now. This was like 20 years ago, but it's Kendall, which that pocket of Miami. It's very much mostly Hispanic speakers, and it was interesting because I speak some Spanish, but I wasn't speaking Spanish to them to teach them. So it's so interesting how you know you cannot be speaking their language to teach them, and you can still teach them. So it was a cool experience.
That intrigues me right there. So you're teaching them to speak English. They're Spanish speakers, but you're not translating. You're not going.
No, it was like there was a lot of imagery. There was a lot. There was a whole program. Like I didn't create the program. It was a program that I was teaching, but they didn't. There was occasional where I would say some things in Spanish when I knew, but it wasn't even like a struggle. It really it was pretty amazing. I think it was the imagery. And then also it's a group of people, so they could help each other too, if someone didn't get it and another one did. But I think the bigger thing is just being patient with people so they feel comfortable to learn. And then it comes easier, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, when I first came to America, I'm like, I didn't know anything about, I didn't know any Spanish at all. And the ranch that I worked on when I first got here, it was interesting because the Hispanic guys that worked there, you know, they'd say, Buenos dias, ¿cómo está? And I would say in Australia, I'd tell them that in Australian, that's g'day mate, how you going? And every American you try to teach that to tries to say the word. So they say, good day, mate, you know, whereas the Hispanic guys, they just said what I said. So these guys had this perfect Australian accent. I'd say, g'day mate, how you going? And he'd go, yeah, g'day mate, how you going? He had no idea what he was saying. I mean, how you would spell it, but he was just saying exactly what I said. So he had this perfectly good accent because it wasn't like they were reading the words and trying to pronounce them.
Right, right. That's so funny. I could picture this.
it was pretty cool. And then the other job you said you had, you worked in an international school, is that what you said?
Yeah, I thought that I really had such a love for international cultures and the experience that people get when they travel and immersing yourself in another place and another world and learning from that life, that I thought I wanted to do something where I was doing international education in some capacity. This was when I decided journalism wasn't for me. This was my next path. And so I had a couple jobs that were in that realm. I moved to Chicago also for a job doing customized tours to Italy. I just realized that I didn't want to do all this stuff from the United States. Like the enjoyable part of it would be to be there and not create something from a desk. And then, you know, so I moved out of that wish at some point, but that was the path that I was on at that time.
So you moved to Chicago to do the job with international tours. Were you actually doing the tours?
No, like I worked at a company. The owner was Italian, and we would arrange people would tell us kind of what they wanted to do while they were in Italy, and we would create a whole package for them and issue the tickets and like an itinerary and all of that. And because I had thought I wanted to take people to Italy to see the real Italy, like. I was very fascinated with how the food was produced and like the marble quarries and just the industry there that was very indigenous to Italy. I wanted people to see that real experience. I mean, of course, art is an aspect of Italy too, but I'm talking about, you know, things that they produce and make. And so I was working for that company to learn a little bit more, you know, about what kinds of things I could offer. But then I decided I don't want to live in Italy full time. So this job would never satisfy me from a desk. So that's what, you know, move me away from it.
And then you said you started working for some sort of holistic medicine sort of a place. What was that after your Chicago move?
It was, actually it was exactly after that. It was the practitioner that had helped me with my health. I started working for her. So I worked in an administrative position. And then she's always been my mentor since that. So, you know, her practice has grown so much and her education too. And she's just an amazing person. And so I started working for her, you know, learning the ins and outs, not necessarily with any intention of doing this work. I just enjoyed the environment. So that gave me a glimpse, you know, but it was all like little baby steps. Like it was kind of like, there's your first breadcrumb, but that's not where I landed yet either. I kept still exploring some other things before I was putting the pieces together.
Yeah. Well, there's two parts to this. One is your health journey and one is your, what do you want to do in life journey? So when you're working for the holistic medicine person, how's your health then? Are you getting better? Are you stable? There are more symptoms, you know, the whole circle of you fix one thing and something else pops up. Is that still going on then?
Yes, but not as bad. And I think also like a big part of what was stressing me was I was living through a big time of change. I was moving to different places. I wasn't sure exactly where I was landing career-wise. And I think, especially knowing what I know now, just being in that kind of a period in your life can create a lot of instability in your body if you don't have ways to ground yourself or things you ground yourself in. And at that time, I was in very much like, I just need to be in control or I don't know what's going to happen next. And so it was creating a stress response. So I knew that I wasn't working for her for a long period. I was planning on moving to New York. This was in Florida. So that next move, that impending move, that whole process was creating some stress in my body too. And it's like, you can only take so many supplements if you're not dealing with, you know, what's going on emotionally too. So I do believe that I was better digestive wise, but I do remember that my skin was still a problem then. And I remember that she was testing me like weekly while I worked there. So I was still working on my health while I was working there.
So what was your, what would you say would be your, like your next big breakthrough as far as trying to solve the symptoms that you're having? Was it a physical breakthrough, or was there a mental part of it? Because, you know, there's the whole mind-body connection sort of thing, and there's a lot of stress going on. Did you, you know, the next step, was it more understanding about your mindset that was causing the stress, or was it more solving the body issues?
It's such a good question. And there have been times where I've tried to think back, like, what was it? And I just feel like it wasn't one thing. I feel like that's a big reason why I work the way I work right now, because it's never one thing. But I do think there's just starting to step into my passion, you know, starting to try to figure some things out. You know, also the move to New York, I think, was really good for me because I had a lot of friends here. And I think starting to enjoy life, life was feeling kind of heavy and serious when I was going through all this change and not knowing what was next. And I was sad all the time. It's so crazy when I look back now how serious I was taking this period of time, but I just was. And I think being in New York and kind of coming back to myself, you know, enjoying a new city, exploring it, you know, also I was in grad school at that time. And, you know, I was back with a lot of my friends that I'd had from college. And just, I think that was a big thing. Like just the emotional piece was calmed a little bit more. And I think that was facilitating some change for me too, is the stress response and just enjoying, like finding a way to find pleasure in life, I think was a big impact.
So you're in grad school. What are you studying now?
I was in grad school then, and it was food studies and nutrition. So I had switched into it. That's when I started to be like, okay, I think I need to do a little bit more with this.
So you've given up the journalism thing, and now you're thinking food studies and nutrition. Was it the food studies and nutrition, was it – what's the term I'm looking for? Was it more Western medicine food studies, or was it more holistic? And the reason I'm asking that question is my wife, when I first met her, she worked for a lawyer, but she was an aerobics instructor, and she, you know, she was a step aerobics instructor, but she was really big at the time into low fat, no fat. What she didn't realize is if you take the fat out of things, but it's still going to be edible, that you created a chemical shitstorm.
Yeah.
And then, a number of years ago, probably it could be 20 years ago now, it could be 15 years ago. And this is, you know, this is quite a ways on from her aerobics instructor days and her low fat, no fat thing. But I found a book in Australia. I was in a bookstore, and it was called The Big Fat Lie. And it was written by a journalist, actually, from New York, actually. And she was a food critic. And she worked for a magazine, and she'd go around to all these restaurants being a food critic. So when you go to a restaurant as a food critic, they feed you for free, but you don't get to choose what you eat. And so they were giving her all these rich, creamy, butter-filled sauces and stuff that she normally wouldn't eat because it's fat, it's not good for you. And she started losing weight. And she's like, hang on, I can't be losing weight what I'm eating. What's going on here? So that she did a whole, went down the whole rabbit hole of fat and how did we, what, why is it supposed to be so bad for you? And fat makes you fat and all of that sort of thing. And it all went, she went all the way back to the 1960s, I think it was. And there was an epidemic of heart related deaths in America, and rising obesity, and the American Medical Association was looking for someone to explain what was going on, and there was a food researcher, I think he was, and his last name was Kellogg. I don't think he was the cornflake guy. He was actually, if you've ever heard of K rations, like the army makes K rations, he's the guy that developed those things. But anyway, he hit upon this idea that fat is the problem. And so then, and that was his hypothesis, and then he got the American Heart Association on board, and so they were all over it. But then there was all these other scientists who started studying fat, and they said, no, but that's wrong. And so if they wrote a one-page article in the New England Journal of Medicine about how it's not fat that's the problem, he had the backing of the American Heart Association, and he'd write a three-page article to refute their claims. And it was just this whole, you know, it was just this whole, the machine controlled the narrative sort of a thing. And the guy wasn't trying to do it wrong in the first place, but he hit on this hypothesis, but then he didn't want to be wrong. He didn't want to be proven wrong. So he backed it up. And like I said, he had the backing of the American Heart Association. But in this book, she goes into why do Inuits eat blubber and they don't have obesity, and yeah, really got into that whole thing. And so, sorry, that was a long rambling segue into the stuff that you were studying. Was it more BS from the machine, or was it a bit more holistic looking at all the stuff?
So that was the challenge in that time. It was harder to find a program that was comprehensive and that was like a degree-based program that was holistic. So I did a program. The food studies and nutrition was kind of, it was not a registered dietitian program. It was the really cool part about the food studies aspect was I was actually learning about different cultures and how they eat and their health related to how they eat. And then, yes, there was the nutrition piece as well, but it was not Western. It wasn't holistic either. It was kind of in the middle, but the programs that I did, subsequently that I did on my own that were not like degree based, they were just certifications from different institutes. They were all holistic because I had to fill in. Like I didn't feel like I was getting what I needed from that, but it gave me a degree to give me the credibility that I felt like all these people needed. Like my training and my electrodermal screening was a year long program in Atlanta, you know, or I did a course. I did a whole series of courses, like where they looked at like the eye, iridology, and how you can determine illnesses from the eye. Or there were so many things that I did to put everything together, and my own experience with what I was going through. I was trying so many things and digging into things and learning. And it's like, I feel like I kind of made my own education, because at that time, I think there's a lot more now, like option wise, but at that time, holistic was still a little weird, and it just wasn't mainstream as it is now. I feel like I'm ancient when I say this, but it's just, it really exploded in like the last 10 years, 15 years. And at the time, I think I was doing it 20 years ago, and it was like right on the cusp of becoming something.
But if you think about, and I want to get back to the iridology thing here in a second too, because that's fascinating. But if you think about what exploded in the last 10 or 15 years, like, you know, we talked about the internet before, and, you know, how it could be bad. It's bad, you know, having access to stuff all the time and you're not very present. But the upside of that is there is no reason to be ignorant anymore.
Yeah.
And there is no reason to believe the bullshit that the machine kind of tells you, because you can kind of look up your own stuff. And it's, you know, I think that exploded, and looking at the world differently has exploded in the last 10 or 15 years, because we don't have to read the paper. You know, we can look things up, and we can, you can look at other cultures. You don't have to go to India to see India or whatever. You know what I mean? And so I kind of think that's part of the reason for that explosion, you know, that you can, there's different perspectives available to you rather than the one that your family of origin or your society has told you about.
Yeah. It's like the world became smaller. So we had access to information we wouldn't have had before. And even like with what you were saying with the no fat thing, it's like when they started to look back at even France, a society that's generally, you know, fairly healthy, like nothing is low fat, you know? Right. And it's like suddenly we're the authorities, you know? And it's like they've been doing this a long time, and I think they know what they're doing. Like they have a much healthier way of life.
I have a, a friend who did a, it was years, this is probably 20 years ago, but she did a, like a culinary course, and the teacher was this French guy, and he apparently used to drink a bit at night, and he'd come in, if he had a hangover in the morning, he'd kind of come in and he'd be holding his head with one hand and he'd just say, more butter, add more butter. Anytime I asked him a question, it was add more butter, you know, and then for quite a long time, butter was the enemy and they wanted you eat, you margarine. Wanted you to eat margarine, which is like, you know, two chemical points away from plastic.
Yep. Yeah. They would do that experiment where you leave margarine out like on a window for like weeks and it's still sitting there. Nothing happens to it. It's very scary.
It's like the McDonald's test where you put the McDonald's there and 3 years later that it still looks like it looked. My son, you know, it's funny, you've been to other countries and know the difference between bread in other countries and bread in America. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Australia, and if your bread's 4 days old, it's got green spots on it.
And that's how it should be.
Right. And I remember a few years ago, actually it was the first trip we ever went to Europe, and we went for like 3 weeks or something or other. My son was still in high school and he was on some sort of student council thing, but they did some sort of a fundraiser at school and they sold hot dogs and hamburgers and whatever. And so he'd been shopping and we had a garage full of food that they used, but there was some left over. And I remember there was some hot dog buns or some hamburger buns sitting on our counter in a plastic bag before we left for Europe. We go away for 3 weeks. We come back. It looks exactly the same as when we left. And it's like, that's not food.
That's so crazy. It gives you perspective when you see something like that.
Yeah. And especially when you've been, you know, if you've grown up with it, you don't know bread can go moldy in 3 days, but it
should. Was the quality of food in Australia like very high, like growing up for you? Did it feel different than the US?
Back then, yes, it was. I grew up on a farm and, you know, we milked our own cow. We drank raw milk, you know, lots of it. You know, I'd get home from school and you'd have, you know, half a gallon of milk and a milkshake sort of a thing.
It's amazing.
And you'd have your milk on your cereal. It's funny, you know, it has a bit of a raw taste, which now I would love. But at the time, we used to, you know, if I ever spent like the night at a friend's house in town or something or other, I would be so excited because you get to have what I would call town milk on your cereal in the morning. So town milk is the milk that comes in the carton or the bottle, which has a more like, say, refined sort of a taste than what I had was regular milk, you know. But asking about the difference between Australia and America, when I was a kid, we just ate ingredients. You know, there was nothing that came out of a box.
Yeah.
You know, even if mum made a cake or whatever, it was ingredients. Like it was all the ingredients. But I remember when I first came to America, my first trip to the supermarket, I was at the milk fridge and I was trying to find the milk. And there was all kinds of milk. There was vitamin D milk, there was 2% milk, there was this milk, there was that milk. And I finally had to ask someone, where is the milk? And they go, that's milk. And I said, yeah, but I just want milk. They've all some other kind of milk. And I turned out what I was looking for was actually the vitamin D milk. But in Australia at the time, there wasn't that, you know, there wasn't that option sort of thing. It was all pretty basic.
Like all those choices. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely a thing here. You know, everything is in a box. And now it's like, you know, there's a thing I always tell my clients, which is avoiding seed oils. I don't know if you know about the seed oils, but that's what's in a lot of the boxed foods. And it's, you know, there's a lot of studies that show that it can cause, you know, cardiovascular issues, immune system issues, inflammation. And so many of the foods we have in these boxes are full of them. So you were definitely better off. That's for sure.
Well, tell us about seed oils then. What do they do?
So it's oils like canola oil, sunflower oil, safflower oil. You know, it's just, there's like eight of them. And canola oil, if I didn't say that, they're heated to high temperatures. You know, they're creating toxicity in the body. So, and they're added usually like as a shelf stabilizer or, you know, there's some other component. But I mean, you'll even see some products will say now seed oil free. I even listened to, I think it was the nutritionist for the Knicks, the New York Knicks, who said that like the first thing she does with all her players is get them off of seed oils, because there's really, there's a lot of studies that show it's creating inflammation in the body. And in an inflamed state, you're more prone to disease and immune system dysfunction. And so I always tell my clients, like, you know, there's a lot of companies now that will have a healthier option that don't have seed oils in it. Like, look for them because we're overexposed to them right now.
Right. Yeah. We haven't used, as far as cooking, we haven't used seed oils for quite a long time. We use avocado oil.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah.
Most of our cooking now. Yeah, it's just so interesting, you know, like you said, the nutritionist for the Knicks, you know, cutting out little things like that. Have you ever heard of a guy named Sir Dave Brailsford?
No.
So he was he had an MBA from Harvard, maybe, in British cycling, the British cycling team, you know, the British Cycling Association. Well, British cycling had not won an Olympic medal for 70 years or something or other. And they had this guy come in, and he was an amateur cyclist, I think. He was into the cycling, but he had this MBA, and he came into the British Cycling Association, and he started making these small changes. And I can't remember what the small changes were, and I'm going to look it up while we're talking. I'm going to do the Joe Rogan right here, except I don't have an assistant to do it, Sir Dave Brailsford. And he had a term that he called, but it was about making lots of tiny little changes that made up to marginal gains. Thank you. That made up big differences. And so he came in and he, you know, something you're worried about with aerobic athletes like bike riders is getting a cold or whatever. So he had the team practice washing their hands every hour, on the hour. Like, they got a habit of doing it. He changed things, like he changed the valve stems on the bike tires so that they were, you know, 4 grams lighter than the other one. You know, he didn't make any big changes, but he made all these small changes. He figured out what's the best mattress to get the best night's sleep. And everybody on the team had that. When they went to their first Olympics after he'd been there, they took their own mattresses with them. Went to the Olympic Village, took their mattresses out of the room, threw them out, and used their mattresses. At that Olympics, none of the athletes were allowed to shake hands with anybody else, trying to reduce the risk of germs or getting a cold, all that sort of thing. Their first Olympics, after he took over, they won 75% of the available gold medals or something like that. Haven't won an Olympic medal in 70 years. And then after that, they basically steamrolled pretty much the world in cycling. And it's a term called marginal gains, which you can apply to anything, but it sounds like this nutritionist is applying that to the Knicks. First thing, it's not just the seed oil, but that's one of the things that causes the inflammation.
Yeah. And I, even when I work with clients, I try to take, I don't know, one or two main like priorities and start with that and just let them work on that, master that. Then we add something else in.
Then you start adding it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's too extreme. Otherwise people can't maintain that.
But the point I was trying to get was it's not necessarily huge, big things you got to do, but you got to start. Got to start somewhere. So the seed oils are not good. What is there a common thing that's like usually the first thing you've got to change with someone's, say, their diet?
A lot of people are aware of foods that they're sensitive to and they're still eating them. So I think that's something, is like helping people to understand, okay, like it's not just that they're not good for you and you don't know what's actually happening in your body. Like, let me explain to you the cycle of events that are happening when you're exposing yourself to this food over and over and over again.
Can we pause for a second?
Sure.
While I put my hands over my ears and go la 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 la.
But I don't like know what those you're sensitive foods. To, so you're they, safe.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, as soon as you said that, I remember our naturopath did a food allergy test thing a few years ago, and when I looked at it, some of the things I like were quite high. But kale was really low, so I got a black marker and I filled that line in to where I made it look like it was the worst thing for me. I said, I think I actually took a picture and posted on Facebook and said, their machine was wrong because kale wasn't high in something I shouldn't be eating.
Your dream.
Yes. Yeah.
It's moderation though. Like I know, like for me personally, I don't do well with corn, but popcorn is literally one of my favorite foods on the planet and I just can't avoid it. So I tell myself like every 2 weeks, you can have a small amount. It's just the daily overexposure that causes the problem. So it's teaching people maybe ways that they don't have to fully eliminate depending on what the reaction is, but how to add in other things in between so that you're not creating, it's almost like creating a wound over and over and over again in the same spot when you keep eating that same allergen and it tears at the gut and it causes, you know, a lot of mineral deficiencies, adrenal issues. So there's just a chain of reactions when it's a daily exposure. So I think that, and then protein is usually another thing that I feel like, and it can be vegetarian protein, but it's, I just feel like a lot of people are not getting enough protein. And so those are kind of the two things that I usually feel like I'm dealing with right off the bat.
Let me ask you a question about gluten. Mm-hmm. Can people over, as they age, can they become gluten intolerant as they get older?
It's a good question. So there's a lot of theories with what's gone on with the gluten and like a big part of the problem is the pesticides that the gluten is sprayed with. So, you know, you hear stories and it's not just a story of people say going to Italy and being able to eat bread, but they can't eat it here because it's got glyphosates here, you know, the pesticide. Yep. But there's also, you know, the integrity of your digestive system can be compromised over time if there have been toxins, stress, if there's something going on with your digestive system, it can make you more intolerant to many things if it's not healed. So that's the, you had mentioned early on that I had had leaky gut. That's kind of the principle of leaky gut. It's the idea that there are some tears in the intestinal lining. And when those tears are there, food is leaking out from the intestine into the bloodstream. So when it does that, your body looks at anything as an offender because it doesn't belong in the bloodstream. It's supposed to be in the gut. So it's then backing up and figuring out, okay, well, what caused those tears in the lining? Like, is it a toxin? Is it adrenal stress? Is it a food that you're eating over and over? Something is breaking up that lining. So we need to fix it and remove the offender. And then sometimes that sensitivity that someone suddenly experienced is no longer there. Because it's just about fixing the gut. So it depends on the situation.
Yeah, I'm getting the feeling that bread didn't used to affect me, but I'm feeling like it's starting to.
Yeah, yeah. It's also a lot of the chemicals too.
Right, yeah. I've got a question for you. I'm going to have you diagnose me. No, I'm not. do you feel, well, I'll tell you a story and then you tell me what you think of that. And this has to do with like with your emotions and stuff. So a number of years ago, I did a plant medicine journey and my intention for the, you know, you've got to set intentions and change your diet and all that sort of thing before. But my intention was to try to have a bit of a heart opening. And I did. And then about 2 weeks later, I thought totally unrelated. I went into atrial fibrillation one day. So my heart was beating 189 beats a minute for about 36 hours. And okay, it was a couple of weeks later, so I didn't even think about it. But then probably a year or so later, I did a different plant medicine and that journey was about my solar plexus chakra, trying to get that kind of unstuck. Which did, and a bit, and then, I don't know, 2 weeks later, maybe 2 or 3 weeks later, I went in the emergency room with diverticulitis.
Wow.
And then I'm like, actually, our naturopath, I called her after that, and I said, hey, can I run something by you? This might sound weird, but do you think, and I told her about those two things, I said, do you think, you know, I've been pretty shut down most of my life. I said, do you think, as I get my body to start communicating with me, I'm going to find out that I'm actually quite ill and, you know, it hasn't been talking to me. And do you think illness can be stuck emotions in the body? And she had a theory on that. I'm just wondering what you think of that.
I mean, I definitely think that. I mean, so much of what I do is kind of bridging the physical issue and the emotional. So especially when it comes to the chakras too. But I don't look at it as, you're ill, I kind of look at it as your body's trying to tell you something, or your body's trying to shift you towards something, and it's manifesting in whatever way you'll notice. You know, so it's kind of like, how am I going to get your attention? If it's emotional, you may suppress it and you'll never realize it. But if it's physical, it's like a alarm. And then you think, oh my gosh, my body's collapsing, but it's not really, it's trying to tell you something, you know? So, I mean, and yeah, with the solar plexus thing too, I mean, I always say when I'm working with a client on solar plexus, like, what are you not digesting in your life? Because that is the emotional core of that chakra for me, at least when I hear people.
Wow. So we have, I don't know if you know, but we have a podcast summit. So, you know, we'll have the guests from the, you know, previous year's podcast, and then we'll gather them all somewhere and have a summit where they present on stage and do like a TED style talk. And then we have panel discussions and things like that. But we had one in Australia last year, and they're usually quite moving. You know, they bring things up and things move through you and whatever. So we get done with that on the Sunday night, and we walk, my wife and I and a few other people are walking down this downtown to go to a restaurant, and we walk up to this traffic light, and I press the, you know, crosswalk button. And as I do, I'm like, I turned to Rob and I said, I just went into atrial fibrillation. Like, I can feel it. And she said, you need to go to the hospital. Well, the first time I went to hospital with atrial fibrillation, you know, I didn't know what it was, and I thought maybe I'm having a heart attack or whatever, but they told me that the thing you're worried about with atrial fibrillation is your heart is not beating completely properly. It's kind of fluttering, and you can get blood stuck in there that can clot, that when it comes out can go up and cause an aneurysm. So you're worried about a clot. But they said you can have atrial fibrillation 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and if you for the whole year, and in that year you've got a 30% chance of having a clot. So it's, some people live with it. So it's not like, oh my God, I'm, you know, run to the emergency room. And when my wife said, well, you want to go to the, you know, this atrial fibrillation, I felt it at this traffic light. And she said, do you want to go to the emergency room? I said, no, it's okay. And it's not, I'm not listening to it, but, you know, we're in Australia for 4 or 5 days or whatever. If I get back to America and still there, I can go do something about it. But I didn't think it was a big deal. But what was interesting was about a day later, and this is the weird thing, so it's in my chest. My heart is not beating properly and it's fluttering, okay? A day later, that feeling dropped into my upper solar plexus. And right then I said to Robin, and now I've got this sharp pain in there, you know, and Robin's like, you want to go to the emergency room? I said, what am I going to do? Go to the emergency room and say, you know, my atrial fibrillation just turned into a, like the two things aren't related. I said, obviously this is some sort of emotional thing moving through me because of what happened at the summit. And so I had these pretty intense pains in my, you know, just below the top of my ribs right there for a couple of days, and it kept moving. It ended up moving down into lower stomach cramps, like I need to go to the bathroom really bad, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. But it was the weirdest thing. It went from a heart problem to a intestinal problem, almost to a bowel problem. But nothing came out. It was interesting but when it went from the heart to the next bit down, that's when I kind of twigged, like, this has got to be an emotional thing, because though a heart problem is not, you know, it's if you've got something in your gut, your upper gut, you know, and it goes further down, you know, it's in your stomach and it goes further down through your intestine. That's one thing, but it doesn't come out of your heart and go into your gut.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's amazing that you recognized that though, and didn't just panic and, you know, think something major was going on. Because in that moment, a lot of times you're not in the most calm state.
Yeah. So what do you think of that emotion? You know, like, do you feel like, I mean, it happened to me, so I know what it was. Well, I know what my experience was, but do you feel like emotions can travel through your body and cause things like that?
Oh my gosh. I mean, definitely. I remember when I lost my mom like 10 years ago. And I remember when I was going through that whole process, I had a rib head that kept popping out in my back. Like it felt actually like a heart attack. And I think, and it was 100% emotional. And I kept going to the chiropractor because there's a, it's depending on which rib head it is, it can feel very intense. Like you can't breathe. Mm. And I'd never had that in my whole life. And it happened multiple times during that period. And that was just emotions and grief, you know? So I 100, I mean, I could think of 1,000 examples, but it's just, it's very, very common. I mean, even as I work through the chakras with people, like each one has a physical component. And then we talk about the emotions, like whether if someone's dealing, like I was mentioning, a time of transition or a time of change, a root chakra, that would be more root chakra. And for that, it's adrenal, it's kidney usually. So then sometimes there can be issues around fear, like lots of issues around fear. And fear can manifest in the lower back, or fear can manifest in your joints, your knees, like your support structures, you know, like the support structures in your body. Because maybe the support structures in your life, your career, your relationship, whatever it might be a little uncertain in that moment. And now it's manifesting physically in your body, you know? So there's a lot of examples like that.
That's the second time you've said one of those things that made me go, like that before you said people have a digestive issue and you say, what are you having trouble digesting in your life? And like, you just said kind of the same thing. Their support structures, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I had a client who kept fracturing things for like a couple months. It was like one ankle, then it was another ankle. Then she fell ice skating. It was a wrist. And she was going through a lot of the marital issues, and like they ended up getting divorced. And it was just like, it was a support thing, you know? So it was, I mean, she realized, she's like, I don't know how to stop this. And I'm like, you got to get centered in the emotional aspect of this. So it was just more of a wake up for her because she wasn't really facing it.
All right. Wow. Okay. So I think we got quite a bit off track from your life right there. Oh, you had mentioned iridology, and I wanted to get back to that. Can you tell us about iridology? Because I had someone at a horse training clinic of mine years ago who was a participant in it, and she said she does something about it. And that was the first time I'd heard of it, and I still don't know much about it, but it sounds fascinating. Can you tell us about iridology?
Yeah, it's a study of looking at the eye to be able to look at maybe like predispositions towards certain conditions, but it also can be like you may be able to pick something up that's currently going on. I mean, they use a special like glass like to look into the eye so you can see it, you know, closely. Sometimes there's like a little fleck in a certain spot that can indicate something. You know, it's kind of like there might be some cloudiness that can indicate something. Maybe sometimes like you can even see like diabetes in the eye. There's a lot of different conditions. I don't personally use it in my practice because I have the machine that I use the testing for, and it gives me much more like specific information, but right. The classes were fascinating.
So you get to look close up at eyes in the class.
Yeah.
The human eye up close is fascinating, isn't it? It's almost like you're
so
looking into the universe or something, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like there's just so much going on in there. And when you look at it closely, it's like incredible.
And then I guess if you have an education on how to read what it says, then it's even more fascinating.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, those classes were incredible. I would recommend it to anybody who just was interested.
Did you, because this is what would happen to me if I took that class, did you find it have a hard time having a conversation with people after that? Because you stand there and you're kind of just looking at their eye, trying to look at the things instead of listening to what they're saying.
Or it's that you think you have everything that you just learned about. It's like you learn about a condition. Oh, do I have it? You know, it's like you start to become a hypochondriac like for yourself, you know,
I've not really wired that way. I've never.
Yeah.
You know, some people should not look at Dr. Google.
Right.
I'm not one of them. I tend to go the other way. I tend to not pay attention to stuff rather.
Which
than,
is good. Yeah. Than
a, well, you know, it's, you know, I think there's a balance in the middle. I'm a bit too far one way, you know, my wife, she's on the other side. So we kind of balance each other out a bit there.
Yeah. Yeah. You always need the one that it's like one is on the other end. You need the other extreme or you're really in trouble.
Yes. It's all about balance. I forget where we were in your life. Okay. You were working for the holistic practitioner. When did you actually start, you know, you weren't sure that's what you wanted to to do then? When did you actually decide this is what I want to do?
When I moved to New York, I did a graduate program, and it was started off as a master's in international education. And it was after the first semester of that program that I switched into food studies and nutrition, because I was realizing that, like, my entire free time, I was researching health things. I wasn't even wanting to do the homework for this program or even paying attention. So it was at that moment that I was like, okay, this all happened to me for a reason, and I just got to focus on this. And so I completed that program. And then, as I was mentioning, I added a lot of other programs to the mix to kind of feel like I had more of a complete education. And then I started, just once I finished, seeing nutrition clients that were referrals, like friends of friends, out of my apartment, because I didn't have an office. I didn't really know what I wanted to do just yet. And then I ended up, was still dealing with some back issues at that time. And I was going for physical therapy. And in the physical therapy center, they were renting rooms for practitioners. And so I was like, I'm going to just take a leap. And I rented a room just 2 days a week to start seeing nutrition clients privately there. And then I was like opening myself up to the public, where prior it was just, you know, friends of friends. So that's really where it started. So my back issue actually led me kind of to just get started with my practice.
Have you ever heard of the Japanese term ikigai?
No.
So I'll read it, what the official explanation here. Ikigai is a Japanese term that blends two words, iki meaning to live and gai meaning reason, which translates to a reason to live. And it's a concept that encourages people to discover what truly matters to them and live a life filled with purpose and joy. And in Ikigai, there's this Venn diagram, and there's these four circles that overlap each other. One is what you love, what the world needs, what you can be paid for, and what you're good at. And they all cross in the middle. And so you were doing this degree on international studies, but it's not what you're passionate about. You're passionate about, you know, what you love. You loved this learning about this other stuff. And so you stopped on the international thing and went to that. And it sounds like you've found the thing to where it's the thing, you love it, you're good at it, you can be paid for it, and it's what the world needs. And you found that spot in the middle. And so big round of applause for you.
Very kind, thank you.
You're in the zone. That's cool.
I mean, I feel grateful, honestly. You know, I feel grateful for any clients that I see, or just, I feel grateful for the choice to be able to choose what I wanted to do. You know, I mean, I know, like, it was later generations that were even able to have the luxury of choosing, where, you know, before it was, you have a job as just to pay the bills. You're not, right. You know, don't have the luxury of having a passion in there. So to be able to say that I genuinely love what I do, it's wholehearted. So I feel very lucky.
And so, how long have you been doing what you're doing now in this iteration? How long have you been doing that?
Because I first started with just nutrition, and then I added in a lot of other things. So I would say probably 20 years since I've been doing, okay. Maybe 15 since I've been doing everything.
Right. And so when I looked up your bio, it's on a website, and there's a picture of a whole bunch of people there. Do they work with you, work for you?
I'm imagining those are retreat pictures that you're seeing.
Oh, okay.
I think that's what that was. I've done like 10 years worth of group retreats in different locations. And so it's probably group retreat pictures that you're seeing. Okay. Right now I have a couple people that work with me, but it's about 2 to 3. So if you're seeing larger, I don't think it's that.
Okay, it must have been a retreat picture. So are your retreats all, I don't mean they're all the same, because they'd all be, you know, we have retreats here at our place, and it just depends the energy of, you know, you get the 8 or 9 people that you have or whatever, and it's just all the combination of those depends on where it takes it to. So I realize they're not all the same, but are all your retreats got basically the same name, or is some of them on different things? I'm not explaining myself here.
No, I understand what you're saying. Yeah. When I first started the retreats, they were more like just on holistic health and kind of bringing together groups of people to learn, to experience their own healing, to enjoy, to relax. And then I started to bring in the chakra element so that I could fuse the emotional piece along with the wellness. And we did it in fun ways, like, you know, learning about root chakra, but I'm teaching people how to roll out their feet with like a tennis ball and stimulate certain reflexology points as a way to ground themselves. Or they were getting tangible things. There was breath work that they would learn with each chakra. So it was a lot that they could take home and be able to implement in their life. And recently I, you know, segued, as I was mentioning, into some more one-on-one and two-person retreats, because at the end of every group retreat, they would fill out an evaluation, and hands down, every single retreat, there would be several people that would say, I wished I had more one-on-one time with you to work on some of my specific stuff. And I tried, like I was trying to make time for this, trying to, you know, alter the retreats to give, say, the first five people that sign up a one-on-one session. And it just wasn't working. It's like, you know, 10 hours of your time on a weekend. So the one-on-ones are new. I haven't done exactly the same thing throughout, because I'm kind of evolving with what I see that the need is, and right, also where my heart is. So it has changed.
Yeah. When we have the retreats here, that there's, you know, it could be four or five or six different parts of it. And some of the feedback we get, I wish we could have done more of this, or I wish we could have done more of this, but everybody says, we wish we could have done all of the same thing. And so, yeah, we've actually thought of actually like breaking up the retreat, you know, like let's say we've covered six major areas in a retreat, then having retreats that just cover one of them, you know, be a lot more specific about stuff so people can take a deep dive into that. But yeah, it's all good in the hood. You know what I'm going to do now? I'm going to start asking you your questions, because I think you chose some really good questions. And the first one you chose, I love this question because I love books. What book do you recommend the most? And that's not what is your favorite book, but what book do you most recommend to other people?
That happens to be the Manifest book that I just read. Oh, okay. That one just really hit me. So, not to sound like a, you know, broken record about it, because I know we chatted about it, but that I would recommend that one right now. Most recently, that had the most impact on me.
Okay. That was most recently. I'm sure actually at one point in my notes here, it says you spent 3 years devouring books. Let's talk about books. What sort of books were you devouring for 3 years?
It was all a lot of health related books. But then I also got really into travel narratives, like people that moved to different countries and kind of just started their own life, like kind of Under the Tuscan Sun type books, you know, where it was just, they immerse themselves in a culture and, you know, in an experience. And even in my master's program, the food studies program, there was a book that I read it was called Golden Arches East. And it was a book all about McDonald's and how they had to change everything when they would enter a new country. Like, for example, they would make, and again, this may not be true now, but at the time they would make the eating communal, say in like Korea, because the people were, you know, used to sharing at the table. So there weren't individual portions. You would order a larger portion for the family and you would sit down. Or they had a sign, I believe it was in Moscow, that says, we're smiling at you because it's customer service. We're not making fun of you. Or like, it was like they were having to adapt to all the nuances of the different cultures with each, you know, entering of a new market. And I just thought I would read stuff like that, because I thought it was so interesting, because I loved culture and food and how people were eating and living. And so that's what I was reading in those days.
I like to go to McDonald's in different countries just to see what's different on the menu there than in Australia or America. Australia and America is pretty much the same. Probably the difference in Australia is Australians put pickled beets, we call them beetroot, but on our hamburgers. And so you can get, pretty sure you can get that. And an egg too. You get an Australia hamburger usually has pickled beets and an egg on it, as well as tomato, onion, lettuce, the meat, the cheese.
It's interesting to see that. I remember in Italy they had like the salads were much, like they had much nicer vegetables on the salad, and there was a lot more variety. I honestly haven't been in another country in a while to a McDonald's, but in those days I did see the difference too.
Yeah, I was just in Bali and Singapore, but I don't think I went into a McDonald's. I was in Argentina before that, and I went to McDonald's there. And I was in a food court maybe it was in the airport, but I remember reading that there was something on there like, oh yeah, that's an interesting local take on whatever it was, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think in Italy they had I remember there was banana milkshakes too, just interesting varieties on things that we didn't have, you know?
Right.
Seemed a lot more appetizing.
Yeah. Here I am talking to the food nutritionist. We're talking about McDonald's.
I know, but I brought it up. It's not you.
You brought it up. Yeah, it's not me. The next question you chose was, what advice would you give people entering your occupation? And as usual, with guests on the podcast, I have to have you basically explain what occupation you're referring to. Because what you do, I'd say there's probably about five or six different kind of occupations under the umbrella of what you do that a lot of people specialize in. So if you're going to give advice to people entering your occupation, you have to tell us, quantify what your occupation is.
So I guess I would define it as a holistic health practitioner. Okay. So I'd say, first of all, you can't always expect, the main thing I would say is you're not anyone's healer. And the clients that would come in and kind of have an expectation that I'm there to heal them, I would always reframe that and say, you are capable of healing your own body. I'm a facilitator helping you to understand your body better. And I'm teaching you tools to know what your body is saying to you so that you can operate to your best potential. But the clients that would come in that had this mentality that I'm rescuing them, I'm saving them, not a good fit. And so it's about having, good boundaries with that and recognizing that you want to empower people, not have them always depend on you for the rest of their life because they don't trust their own ability to heal. So that is one thing. And then I also think there's an energy of a fear when someone's trusting you with their health. You want to feel like you know enough. And there's a mentality of you never know enough. So it's getting past that, is acknowledging that the person that's coming to you is coming to you because you have something to offer them right now. And it may not be the last step of their health journey. Maybe they have to go to 10 more people, but there is something important that you can give them now. And I feel like that really helps with the insecurity, especially when you're starting out of, oh my gosh, do I know enough? Am I enough to be able to really guide someone in something as important as their health journey?
Don't you think there's a bit of, that's actually not a bad thing though, because I imagine before that you could be where I know enough to be dangerous, and I think I know exactly what I'm talking about, and you've almost got no, you've got no break, or you've got no reservations about what you know. You're like, yeah, I can fix people. You know, you think it kind of starts out there, and then it gets to where then you have all the knowledge you need, but then you don't have the confidence because you know how much you don't know.
It's a balance. I mean, there's people that will be indefinitely getting degrees and certifications because they never feel like they know enough. And so they don't even put themselves out there. They just have all these degrees behind them in an attempt to feel confident enough to do what they want to do. Or then there's people that go out there and they're not in a place of learning and evolving with the client, because you're learning from the client just as much as they're learning from you. So I think it's a balance, you know?
Yeah. It's all about the balance. Okay, so your next question was, where do you go or what do you do to recharge your batteries?
Definitely yoga. I used to hate yoga, so it's very funny to hear me talk about it the way I do now. But I say this every time I finish a class, and nothing makes my body feel as good and my mind as when I do yoga. So that's definitely one. Also, any place on the water always recharges my batteries. And then just, having conversations that feel authentic and deep with people you love. I feel like all of those things and sunshine recharge my batteries.
What did you used to hate about yoga?
I think I was taking classes with teachers that, maybe it was less about the practice and more about a cardio aspect to it. And I felt like it was straining the same muscles over and over and over again in an attempt to kind of not be still, because you can't still your mind. So they're just pushing through yoga in a more of aggressive way, where I like the approach where you feel like you got movement in and you know, but it was at a pace where you could be still, you could hear your thoughts, you could breathe, you know, like that's the real practice. This cardio aspect of it is what I think the mainstream has kind of made it.
Right. Have you ever tried any yin yoga?
I've been wanting to. I have not. Is that something you do?
I haven't. I've done maybe a couple of them. My son's girlfriend's a yoga teacher, and she was telling us all about yin yoga, and I kind of like the idea of just holding one pose for quite a while, because then you've got to still your mind. You know, like those aerobic type yogas, you here, there, downward dog, now, you know, hop forward, now raise up, now bend halfway up, now down, now downward dog, now plank, now seal, you know, now sphinx, now.
Yep. I took a class this weekend. It was like unintentional, and it was more of a power yoga. And I was observing that right at the point when it was supposed to slow down and it was Shavasana and you could just rest and still your mind, people were leaving. They couldn't handle it. They were like, oh, I'm only here for the power part. Like, God help me if I have to hear my thoughts. So they were out of there. And I was like, wow, this is exactly why I don't like this class.
Wow. Have you ever, speaking of stilling your mind and being with your thoughts, have you ever done a float tank?
Oh my gosh, I've wanted to. I've heard incredible things. I have not. Have you?
Yeah, I think I've done three of them. And yeah, it's either a really peaceful place or it's torture, depending on who you are.
Yeah, they have a bunch of places in the city. They have like places you can go and do it. I've just never tried it.
Yeah, I was in New Zealand. I'd been doing some clinics, and my wife, I must have been in Australia doing some clinics, and I flew to New Zealand and did some clinics, whatever. And then my wife flew in there and she said, I've got a surprise for you today. I'm like, okay, where are we going? And we ended up going to this like industrial area. And I'm like, what are we going to do here? Anyway, we go in, and it was a float tank thing. And it's fascinating. If any of you listeners don't know what a float tank is, so most of them are like an egg shaped kind of a pod looking thing, but they're probably, I don't know, 6'6" long, something like that. So a little bit longer than the human body, but it's full of water. And they dissolve, I don't know, like 1,000 pounds of Epsom salts or something in it. So it's more buoyant than the Dead Sea. The water temperature in them is exactly the same temperature as the human body. The air temperature in the room is exactly the same temperature as the human body. And the room will either go pitch black, or some of them, the egg-shaped ones, have a cover that you pull down. But basically it's a sensory deprivation tank. So you put earplugs in and you lay on your back and you let your head lean back, and the water will cover your ears, it'll be just below your eyes there. But you can't feel where you begin. I mean, you end and the water and the air starts, because you can't tell the difference between you, the air, and the water. And so it's almost like it's an out-of-body experience to where you don't have a body.
And how long do you do it for? How long are the sessions usually?
Yeah. An hour.
Did it feel like it took forever, or like did it feel like it went fast?
Oh, I went to sleep. The first one, I think I nodded off. I know I did one in like Wisconsin, Milwaukee or something like that a few years later, and I'd been doing a lot of clinics and I was kind of worn out and had this one day off, and I felt like I'd slept for 8 hours.
Wow.
Like it was just a complete recharge, just kind of turned everything off.
That's amazing.
But some people really struggle with them because there's just you and your mind.
I can imagine they, the silence is probably deafening.
It is. Yeah. The silence, and yeah, there's no sensation. If you get floating around a little bit, you might float along and bump into the edge of the tub. And that's really weird because you don't have a body, and then the body says something to you. It's quite weird. But yeah, if you ever get a chance to do one of those, they're super cool.
It sounds it. I really have heard incredible things about it. I just haven't tried it myself.
Yeah. I've only done a few, but they were interesting. Okay. Your next question is, what do you feel that your true purpose is?
I think it's I know it sounds kind of simple, but to be there to listen for people, like to hold space for them, to listen. It could be clients, it could be friends. I think, you know, there was an aspect of my life growing up where I didn't necessarily always feel heard. And I think, you know, that definitely was magnified during my health journey. And I think a big part of what I do right now with my work is to allow my clients to feel heard, whether that's during retreats or during our, you know, one-on-one sessions. But it's even just during, you know, when people are going through something, I think a lot of it, so much can be alleviated by people just having space to kind of share and feel heard and feel validated. And I think we don't really live in a world where people give each other that time and space. And I think that's why social media is what it is. And, you know, there's just a lot of stuff that you see in the world. And I think it's a byproduct of people really just wanting to have a voice. And sometimes it's destructive. And I think it's just not necessarily having a community or having a place where they can feel heard. And I just think that's part of my purpose for people.
You know, you're one of those people who their traumas are their gifts. You know what I mean? Like you feel like you weren't heard as a child. And then when you had all your intestinal issues and you go to the gastroenterologist and he's talking about wine with your dad and want to flick you a little, you know, antidepressant medicine and he's not listening to a word that you're saying, that, you know, you've experienced on a pretty deep level not being heard, and you know how that feels. And I imagine that gives you a whole lot of empathy for people who want to share stuff and are probably not used to being heard.
Yeah. And I find a lot of people will say that to anyone before. And I think it's because they don't necessarily have people around them that are willing to listen. And I feel like in listening, you're reflecting back to someone what they're saying so they can hear themselves better. You know, maybe they can even hear their own thoughts better when someone else is actually present for them. So I do believe that. Yes.
The last question that you chose was, what quality do you admire most in others?
Kindness, like genuine kindness, like not the kind where someone's overextending themselves to appear kind, but underneath they're resentful. I mean, genuine kindness, where someone just operates out of their heart and they just want to help others, or they have patience with others, or they have a generosity of spirit. Kindness, for sure.
So I've got a question for you, speaking of that. Before we started recording, we're talking about you're in New York City and there was fire engines and stuff like that. I've heard a few car horns honking and stuff. And I'm here on a 42-acre ranch with rolling hills and beautiful oak trees. And I can't imagine living where you live. How do you go about, you're obviously, you know, you feel a lot of empathy with people. You're very connected to people. How do you go living in that busiest city where you're walking down the street and nobody's looks you in the eye, you know, and everybody has this kind of little protective bubble around them? How does that sit with you energetically? Like, does that affect you?
It's so funny. It does. We're lucky because we have a house, like a tiny house, like an hour from the city also. And for whatever reason, that town is a pocket of niceness where people are what I just described, just kind, genuinely to the bone, like kind. And it's a contrast because it's like, wow, I'm just an hour from the city and this exists. And we keep saying it's like stuck in the 60s in all the right ways. And I keep saying, I think eventually I need to live there because I just really resonate with that energy. But then I also feel like there's a reason I'm here too, because people need like a different energy here as well, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a balance, but if this was my life forever, no way, no way, no way. I couldn't do it.
I don't know if you ever saw Crocodile Dundee when it came out back in the 1980s, but when I first came to America, I kind of felt like Crocodile Dundee, not the rugged outbacky part of it, but I'd be walking down the street like, yeah, g'day. How you going? Yeah, g'day, g'day. I'm like, no one talked to me. And I'm like, this is weird. And I remember Crocodile Dundee is in New York City walking in the street like, how you going? G'day. How you going? Tipping his hat. Hey, ma'am, how you going? And no one's looking at him. You
know? Try doing that on the subway. I can only imagine. People would look at you like you were crazy.
Yeah, I imagine they would. But I'd probably be looking at them like they were crazy.
No,
too,
for sure. So. Being kind and being nice shouldn't be crazy. But these days, you know, it's a little different.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of stuff, but I think it's gone the other way too. Like a lot of the things that you're interested in on about a while ago would have been in crazy land too.
Yes, Oh, they were. I mean, people looked at me like I was crazy when I started. And then they would say things like, how old are you? Like they couldn't understand how I was like 24 years old, 25, you know, helping other people with their health. So, you know, there was a lot of stuff I faced in the beginning with people looking at me kind of, you know, sideways, the industry and my age.
Right. You know, these days, I wouldn't say there's a naturopath under every rock, but you talk to people and, you know, I might say something about, oh, yeah, well, our naturopath says this or that or whatever. And they go, oh, yeah, my naturopath. You know, it's not an unusual thing these days. And we talked about the whole internet thing in the last 15 years or whatever. There's no reason to be ignorant about things anymore. There's no reason to be unaware of things. And it's great because you can go down whatever rabbit hole you want to go down.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many, you know, offshoots to this field right now with what you specialize in and, you know, what your title is and how you help people. And it's great. People have options and they can, you know, see who they resonate with and what they resonate with.
This is not a question you chose. It's just something I'm interested in. Do you have a next big thing? Have you discovered something that's like, oh, I want to go down that rabbit hole. It's a rabbit hole you haven't gone down yet. Have you got any new ones on the horizon?
I mean, I started doing these wellness days in the office. I just launched. This is my new thing. It's like a 6 to 8 hour day where someone comes to the office and they get a whole group of different treatments. So it's like an immersion to kind of help them to reset, as opposed to coming in and doing a one-off session, coming back a couple weeks later, another one-off session. I just find that people change quicker when they've devoted the time to really open, because I feel like as the day goes, they're shifting and shifting and shifting. And that's where my heart is right now, is to work with people in a more focused, concentrated way so that I can kind of get to the core. And then we can develop smaller one-off things from there, but just as a jump start and as a way to open them up, you know, and with different modalities, you know. So there's breath work, there's the testing that I do. They could get Reiki, they would get massage, acupuncture, a whole host of things in one day to kind of reset them and send them back out into the world, as opposed to these almost mini sessions that we've been doing. So that's kind of that. And then the one-on-one retreats are where my heart is right now and where I'm jumping to. But I just see that as more of the model of healing that I want. And I want to incorporate nature more. So at some point I feel like I'll have a property that I can bring people to and there can be healing happening there.
Yeah. It sounds like, you know, the thing that you're doing now with the whole wellness day, I imagine if someone comes in for an hour, they haven't even put down their day. They're there for an hour and they still quite haven't put down their day, and then they get to go back into it. Whereas the whole day thing, they come in and it might take them a while to kind of let go and really settle in. But once they're in, I imagine they can stay in there the rest of the day instead of having to try to let go of what just happened and get ready for what's about to happen.
I feel like so much of our stress in life is that what's next, what's next, what's next. And like this, like punching a clock and having to jump from thing to thing that we're never in the thing we're at. So at least if they're like, I'm here and I'm here for many hours, they can be here, you know, and open up, you know, and talk about whatever they need to talk about or be present for whatever advice they're being given.
So that's what you're doing at work. Is there a field or a something outside of that that you are, you know, a new rabbit hole that you've discovered?
It's funny. I would love to learn like the horses with the healing, like the equine therapy. Always been fascinated with that, and I would, whether I would use it with clients or I just learn it for myself, I have looked into that more recently to kind of learn that a little bit more and see where I could learn that. And then I guess the other thing is I really want to have a garden and I want to learn how to grow things and, you know, have my own vegetables and things like that. So those are like my two, you know, non-work things that I want to learn.
Getting back to being in touch with nature.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look where I live, concrete.
One of my previous podcast guests, her name's Kelly Wendorf, and Kelly lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and she does a lot of leadership coaching for like high performing individuals. Like, I forget what I read somewhere that they call her the CEO whisperer, I think, or the CEO shaman, or something like that. But I'm doing a course of hers right now, which is absolutely fascinating. And we just had a Zoom call yesterday, and she was talking about, we're talking about, the conversation was safety, and it was about space and place. There was the two things she was talking about, space and place. And she was talking about a number of years ago, she did a day with a group of Native Americans from somewhere in New Mexico, and they were going to come to the ranch, and it's equine-assisted therapy. And what she has people do is go in with the horses and just be, and how the horses respond to them brings things up. And, you know, she's thinking these people are indigenous. The horses always engage with people. It's just how they engage with them that brings things up. And she's thinking, well, this is going to be beautiful. These horses are going to love the energy of these people and whatever. And she had them go in there, and the horses ignored them, like acted like they weren't there, didn't stay away from them. But like when the horses moved around the corral or whatever, would walk past them like they weren't there, didn't even acknowledge them. And Kelly was kind of scratching her head like, these horses acknowledge everybody. And it's not just one person they're not acknowledging. All of the horses are not acknowledging all of the people. And she couldn't figure out what was going on. And so she started talking to them about that, and long involved conversation. They get to where this group of people, because of the, you know, because of the colonization, and, you know, a lot of these kids were these people were taken away from their parents as kids and all that sort of stuff. The whole conversation came to a head that they felt like they didn't deserve to be in a place. That was their core thing that was going on. And so Kelly did, outside of the horses, Kelly did some work with them and did some exercises with them and got them feeling like they belonged and deserved to be in a place and take up space. And they went back in with the horses, and the horses came over and were like all over them. And it was just, and that's the like really, really skilled people like Kelly and the horses. It's just some of the stories she tells, it's just fascinating. But that one just kind of blew me away, that the horses, you'd think, oh yeah, horses are Native Americans. The horses are going to love them. But there was, the horses ignored them, and it was, it's just such a fascinating story. And I'm sharing that because you think you're interested in the equine-assisted therapy stuff, and I wanted to get you more excited about it, because when you listen, they really tell you things.
That's incredible, and it's incredible that she figured that out. Like, she was able to figure out what it was, because that's, like, deep, very, very deep.
She's like that.
Yeah, that's amazing.
When I had her on the podcast, it was like one of those ones like, wow.
Yeah.
That lady knows stuff. You ever watch Game of Thrones?
Yes.
And little Tyrion Lannister, you know, he says, I drink and I know things.
Yeah.
I don't know if Kelly drinks, but she knows things.
It seems like it.
Yeah, no, she's super cool. And the course is, the course is fascinating. And the people who are on the course are fascinating too. But, yeah, that story really resonated with me. She has a book called Flying Lead Change, and it's all about, it's leadership and wisdom from horses. And, yeah, it's fascinating. You know, I've had a number of podcast guests who are in the equine-assisted therapy field. Some of them are like leaders in the equine-assisted therapy field, like have been doing it longer than anybody. And, yeah, some of the stories they say about the things the horses can communicate to you about people, and people can learn about themselves being around horses, is pretty phenomenal.
I know that I was staying at a property on an Airbnb that had a farm, a small farm, and she had two horses that she said were not as like engaging with people, is how she kind of put it. And I went, and it was right after my mom had passed, and one of the horses came directly to me and just stuck his face like in my face and bowed his head down. And I started crying, and I was like, I got it, you know, and it's, they know, they're incredible beings. They know.
It's interesting. You said, as soon as you said this horses don't engage with people, and my mum had just passed away, and I'm like, I bet this horse walked up and stuck his forehead right against your body.
Yep, that's exactly. Yeah. It was amazing.
Very super cool. Okay, so how can people find you? What's all your social handles and website and all that?
What do we got? My website is mindfulhealth.biz, B-I-Z. And then my Instagram is at mindfulhealthnyc. Those are my main social handles. I'm not on Facebook as much, so Instagram is the better one.
Okay. Perfect. Awesome. Well, it's been a fun chat learning about your journey to how and why you got to doing the great work in the world that you're doing. So thanks so much for joining
me. Thank you. And it's been wonderful to chat with you too. Thank you for having me.
And you guys at home, thanks so much for joining us. And we will catch you on the next episode of the Journey On Podcast.
Thanks for being a part of the Journey On Podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 850 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.